the method.
Idea. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of Unsigned Methods, with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers of literary fiction about their process, technique and craft.
So, it's episode 24. We were joined for this episode by Yara Rodriguez Fowler, who came join us in central London in autumn of 2019. She is the author of Stubborn Archivist, which is published by Fleet. And Yara spoke to us about many different things, including writing, beginning a novel by writing just dialogue, expanding her novel at request of her publisher, who wanted it two or three times longer than the original version that they signed up. The power of white space, shuffling around time frames, and we had an impromptu lesson in 20th century Brazilian politics, something I don't really know that much about.
Yeah, no, it's something I didn't know much about either, but yeah, interesting period, I think. And we talked a little bit about her work in progress, which I think is going to focus on that period a bit more. But anyway, without any further ado, here's Yara Rodriguez Fowler.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh no, thank you so much for having me.
And I guess, well, you've been writing today, so maybe we could start talking about what stage are you in at the moment, and then we can work back to how your whole process works.
Yeah, so it's book two, and the metaphor I usually use to describe where I'm at with it is like, you know, when you are downloading something, or like when you were downloading something more like in the 90s or the 2000s, and it would be like 60% done. Mm-hmm. But like that might actually take ages still. So that's where I think I am.
I see.
Yeah.
But you don't have a mental time frame. There's no bar at the bottom saying 56 hours remaining.
The end of the year, but it's, I mean, I'm doing that emoji right now with my hands where you're shrugging.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And is that a complete first draft stage, or is this, I mean, how do you work? Do you do an initial draft that's just throwing the idea down?
No, so this book, usually I write the different parts of the book separately, so this book has got at least six parts, and then I think another narrative that I'll wind through.
So what would you class as the parts? Is that just sort of chapters, sections like, of the book, or more like themes? Or
long chapters? Yeah. Long chapters, yeah.
So you'd start with, say, a synopsis of five long chapters or something like that? Or
sort of, yeah. Like, and so I'd take them to a sort of final draft stage. So I might, right now I've got like a fairly final draft of one and others that I've barely started. So that's how I'd do it. But I kind of flesh out where they sit in time and how they feel and how they fit into the arc of what's happening to the characters.
And do you know that from when you first start, do you have an idea of the chronology, or how those, say you have five ideas for chapters, do you know what order they're going to be in the final book, or is it not until you flesh them out a bit more that you go, that one that I thought was going to be number three is actually number one, and the one that's number one is actually going to be the ending? Or
So the first book, I did move them around quite a lot, but I always knew what was the beginning and what was the end. And I always knew what the main arc was, which in the first book is kind of around healing and sexual violence and sitting in your body. So it's not like, I don't know, a marriage plot or something like that. So with this one, I have the beginning and the end. And I think if I didn't, I'd just freak the fuck out. Like I wouldn't be able to, I'd just get too anxious about it. But I might mix it up.
And with the beginning and the end, did they, before you started writing, were you quite set on where you were going to end up with those two?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was because it was just a clear, the beginning suggested the end suggested the beginning, or just, it just...
Well, Yeah, so I guess like the beginning is like someone's born and there's a sort of chorus, which is something I've never done before. And they do talk to each other. So there's kind of like a mystery at the beginning, like someone dies and you don't know why, which again is like not what I usually do. And then that kind of is never really answered directly. And then in the end, I think there are going to be like three epilogues that are all like, take it or leave it, mm-hmm. I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in terms of composition, is that from the initial stages of writing? I mean, do you write notes to begin with, or do you just sort of dive in? And...
So, like, I definitely write notes to start with. With the first book, I had a lot of the fragmenty pieces that were always going to exist like that, the bits that are more like poetry. With this book also, I started with this middle chapter for some reason. Sometimes if I know I'm going to take something that actually happened in my life or that I've seen, it's kind of easier to just vomit it out. But sometimes when I have to really, like, you know, really sit down and make stuff up, then it takes a bit more trial and error. But
Do you have a sort of constant process of taking notes? I guess I'm wondering where the sort of origin of the book is. At what point do you know, oh, this is going to be a book? You say, yeah, like you're sort of 60% now.
Yeah.
Do you have a moment where you go, oh, I'm 0%, but today I've just realised all these things have coalesced into this idea of a novel? Or is it more a kind of slow process of taking notes and building up and slowly going, oh, that section of writing I've written over there could be part of a novel with this section of writing, but may not. I just need to keep on working on it until I decide whether it is a novel or not.
I mean, I guess I only have a sample size of one completed novel and this one in progress, but I think what happens is probably the wheels start turning before I know that I'm going to write that novel. So with Stubborn Archivist, I was thinking a lot about representations of trauma and blank space and the power in not giving a graphic description of something, the power in withholding information from the reader. And I was thinking about that from like a trauma writing perspective, but also, and sort of, and then also from like a kind of Latin American perspective. So thinking about like censorship and traditions of coding and and also like post-colonial, so like resisting the form of the realist novel and how that has these very, certainly in England and Britain, this very kind of colonial, obviously like imperialistic history. It's about domination. So what does it mean if the novel is a tool of domination, if the novel is a way of allowing the reader to know and conquer what is being represented in the pages? How can the text resist that? So those are kind of like academic questions that I was interested in, and that I sort of found some texts that I thought were doing that, but not really others. And I was also thinking a lot about that question of domination and knowledge in translation. So the different ways that we translate. So this idea of domestication. So reading a translation that's pretending it was never in any other language. It's just being like, hi, I read a super British, don't worry. Like, and then what does it mean to leave things untranslated? And that as also a different way of holding back and of taking power back and of the text sort of shape-shifting around whoever's reading it. And those are academic questions that I was asking myself in the year before I started writing Stubborn Archivist. And then Stubborn Archivist is a book that's like all about those things, but it's also about the body and about healing and about sexual violence. And again, at the time that the year before I started writing it, I was doing a lot of activism and work around domestic violence in the UK. And all these things just came together in this book. But the way that in terms of writing it actually started, I started writing just dialogue. So I was even thinking again about this idea of a book that feels completely oral. But the thing is also, like, I wrote a very early draft of Stubborn Archivist and it was like 20,000 words, which is like outrageously short for a book. And I sent that to agents and I signed with my agent, who's great. And we sent it to publishers and they were like, yeah, we love the voice, we love what you're doing, but like, get serious, like, make this longer, please. So I then had to go and make it. So I spent 6 months making it twice as long I took it longer. I took it to 50,000 words, which is just over the length of The Great Gatsby. Because, and I was just like, I don't know how long books are. How am I meant to know that? Like, I don't know how many words are on a page. Pages are different sizes. Like, I was just completely not approaching it in that way. And those 6 months were like some of the worst of my life. Like, I was working full time at a communications agency. I didn't have a social life. I was just writing the evenings. No one would give me any guarantee of money. It would be published. Like, it was really hard.
That on spec increase of length is a sort of interesting exercise. Yeah. Because I feel that's, I mean, that's quite a conservative way of looking at books. Surely the sort of form dictates the length anyway. And I'm not, I mean, it still felt like quite a short book. I mean, you said it ended up around 40,000. It's sort of a, I think it probably felt maybe even slightly shorter than that because of the sort of formal way that it's done. But yeah, that must be a real slog to be told, you know, like that, but twice as long.
Yeah, totally. So
what was the, how did you even, I mean, what was the process of bulking it up, as it were? Which sound, that sounds slightly derogatory. I'm not suggesting it was sort of puffed up. But.
Yeah, and some of the stuff that I added, I think, is some of the best bit parts of the book. And I don't think you can really tell anyway which parts came before and after. And also, I got much better as at writing as I wrote. It's like the first long thing I ever wrote was that book. So,
was there a part of you that sort of felt, well, that's it, it is the 20,000 words, what do they mean, they want double, or
did it
always feel kind of incomplete?
Well, when they were like, well, I think they were kind of two separate things. Like, when they were like, we want three times as much, I was like, what the fuck, like, how can I, okay. But then I was also like, well, I want to be a published writer, so whatever, like, I don't really care. I just want to get published. Like, I don't know. There's a part of me that isn't just super pure. It's also like, yeah, I want my money and I want to have a book out.
Yeah. I mean, where's the first sort of roll of the dice and someone is saying like, we like the work, we want to publish it, but these, you know.
Yeah, totally.
These are the commercial considerations, I guess.
Yeah. And I think there is kind of two things. I think one is super legitimate, which was like, they just want more of the story and more of the characters. And I really liked creating that, and I really liked adding that in. And when I signed with my editor, I was like, can I cut 2,000 words? She was like, yeah. So I did have ultimately like agency over it. And the editor I signed with in the end was not that bothered about how long it was, ironically. And we did make a decision like it's going to be a novel rather than like a collection of short stories or like a super like amphibious thing that doesn't have a category. And then I think the other thing, which is what some editors would have liked, would be just to have made it into a normal realist novel, and they would have liked to have there have been a rape scene, and they would have liked to there have been the stuff that is like completely anti what the whole heart of the novel is. So basically I was willing to do the first one quite happily, but the second one, no.
I mean, that's a difficult one to put yourself in those shoes. I mean, I'm sure you could say, well, there's other places I could take this. But I think, yeah, when that conversation actually happens, that would be pretty tricky. But but it's so formally different to a sort of standard realist novel, isn't it? That,
Yeah,
I think you have a good argument to fight your ground.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was fine in the end.
But I think from having read some reviews of it as well, people do focus in on the kind of, because you said you wanted it to be a novel, definitely, and not something that sort of switched between books. But people do sort of focus on the elements of poetry and stuff within it. So how did that, how did you sort of decide on the formatting of it and things when you're writing it?
So it's only really now that I look at it and I'm like, this is so audacious. There's like some pages that just have like four words on them. And I think there was this really, I don't know, like, I think I was always really interested in, like, the materialism of texts and this idea of, you know, like, big margins are a way you can say, like, I can fold loads of paper and, you know, like, big margins and blank space was always something I was super interested in.
And was that something when you were writing it that you had, in, like, those four words, as you wrote them for the first time, you thought they were going to be on a page of their own, or was it as you were editing, you sort of thought, oh, actually, I could just put those four words in, but they came from a clump of text.
No, they were always on their own. And I think I did have somewhere in the back of my head, like, the idea of literally taking up space being powerful and allowing the character to inhabit space. And I wanted people to read it like they read poetry. And I was writing it like I would write poetry. Like, the idea being like there are four words on this page, but like, and it's really easy to read and get through, but I want you to come back to it. I don't want you to just move through it because you've got the plot information you needed. Like, I want you to linger on this because the space is also speaking. And I've written a book that's really easy to get through, and people often say they read it in one sitting. But the idea is that, like, I would like people to sit with it for a while. So, yeah, the poetry bits were always poetry. There was always blank space. There was always a lot of unsaid around what was said. And similarly, like, the parts that are in the mother's voice, I felt really strongly that I wanted the mother character to have secrets, and I wanted her again not to allow her to speak on the page, but also that everything she said was something that she said to the daughter. So there was no like, and this is what she was secretly thinking all along. I really wanted there to be like a lot of the mum that we don't access, because we don't get mums like that in fiction a lot. And I like the idea that mums are their own people doing their own thing with their own secrets and lovers and abortions and whatever. Like, so I also really wanted that to be the way that was in the text.
Mm-hmm. And with the sort of piecing together the time frames of it, was that something that you already had quite set as you went along, or did you go back and sort of shuffle the cards a bit?
There was a lot of shuffling around, actually. So I think that the main arc is kind of about her healing from sexual violence. So I guess there's like the beginning where it's very disrupted narratively, because like trauma does disrupt memory and how we remember stuff, and our inability to recall events as well. And I wanted that to be the opening, and then the middle is when she confronts the ex-boyfriend in the bar, and the ending to be... So this last part of the book, there is really very little mention of him. It's very forward-looking, and I really wanted it to be that way. But the other parts, how they sit, is actually quite negotiable. And actually, the US edition has a different chapter at the beginning. So they've put the Big House chapter at the beginning. I think that does bookend it quite nicely. But I think also there's an element of like not trusting US readers to see that formal stuff at the start and not freak out.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Credit you give the reader.
Yeah, totally. And I quite like that there are different versions of the book with the chapters in different orders. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Has it been translated?
It hasn't. I would absolutely love for it to be translated into Portuguese. I think you'd need a brave translator. And it would have to just be its own thing. It couldn't just be like directly done.
Would you let the translator get on with it, or would there be a temptation to sort of look over the shoulder?
I want to have like a really big conversation where it's like, this text has its own theory of translation. Like, this text is already doing all of this translating work. Can you translate in the spirit of that? And hopefully they'd be like, hell yeah. and then we'd find like parts of it to leave in English and things like that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, what you do with the bits in Portuguese when it's translated.
Exactly, yeah. I think it would just be another text, I think,
That would be an interesting exercise.
Yeah, I would really like that. I think the politics in it is sort of, I don't know, it's really interesting, like Brazilian readers see much more of Brazilian politics in it, I guess, obviously, but it's not a super easy climate to get stuff published in Brazil because of Bolsonaro, the fascist president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's got some viewpoints that might not sit well with the liberalness of the book, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
Well, so, I don't want to divert off into is Brazilian Portuguese different enough from Portuguese that they would have quite different editions if it was would there be a Portuguese market that existed if it was in South American Portuguese?
I don't really spend any time in Portugal, but so I might be completely wrong. So if anyone's listening and is like, that's not true, then fair enough. But like, I think in Portugal, they're very used to consuming Brazilian cultural products, like novelas and things like that. So it's that kind of thing where like the dominant culture asserts itself over the slightly less dominant one, how we're very used to watching American TV here and stuff like that. So I think they just have to deal.
So it's sort of similar. Yeah. Exchange.
Yeah.
And the work that you're working on at the moment, are you sort of carrying on any of the themes or concerns of sort of textuality or ideas of translation? Or
yeah, I mean, in some ways, there are things I'm not doing, which I really loved about the first one. Like, I think the first one has so much playfulness in it around perspective, and it's very close to my perspective, and it's situated in this place where the vocabulary of the text is always drawing on the two languages and is its own bubble, its own world, its own lexicon. Whereas in this book, there are parts that are just Brazilians talking to Brazilians and people to a slightly lesser extent, like British people talking in English to each other. And there isn't that sort of playfulness in every space. But yeah, I mean, I still have a lot of blank space in it. There's still a lot of what's left out. There's still slightly less about sexual violence, but it is about still dictatorship and those kind of traumas, and also intergenerational histories and what's left out. And it's obviously about Brazilian women in South London. There's like no other group of people that I'll ever write about, maybe.
Do remember to like, rate, subscribe.
Is there anything, like you said, you've sort of been working or thinking through some academic questions that underpin the novel prior to it? Was there any reason that you went towards writing it in a fictional format as opposed to in a more academic format? Or?
Yeah, I mean, just the idea of writing a novel appeals to me more than probably writing a PhD. I mean, having said that, it would be great to have a supervisor and funding, but I mean, you know, in that some senses they're quite similar, like lonely endeavours.
Like, do you feel they both sort of head towards the same point, or are there kind of truths that you can uncover through fiction that are not really accessible through academic research, and truths through academic research that aren't accessible fiction, or are they kind of going towards the same?
I think they go towards the same thing, and I always, again, perhaps very arrogantly, assume that I'm just writing kind of, I want people to talk about my books, I want people to write essays about them. I think there's loads of rich stuff in there, like it's, you know, I mean, for me, Stuff an Archivist is like shouting about Derrida, but you know, that's okay that the reviewers don't write about that, and that it's classed as like young adult writing in the US. Like, I really like that it has that versatility, but when I'm writing, I know that I'm in dialogue, not just with whatever, Sandra Cisneros and Zadie Smith and all those people I love, but I'm also in dialogue with Gayatri Spivak, and like, that's how it works in my head. And yeah, it's a conversation, I guess. Yeah.
That was interesting that the Americans market it as
YA,
just to go back to that.
Yeah,
I guess these are all sort of commercial decisions, aren't they?
Yeah, and it wasn't exclusively YA, but it was, I don't know, like also categorized as like YA and here it's been very like, this is a literary book. But it is interesting to me.
I mean, I don't know if I really understand what the sort of qualifiers are for YA. That feels like quite a recent thing, and it's a way to badge books up and shift them. But it's got young people in it. I mean, is that really enough? Is that what it's...
I mean, I actually always really, really wanted that book to be read by young women. Mm. That was like one of my big ambitions for it. The whole book is a kind of about a young woman turning around and saying like, oh, I love you, to her younger self. Like, for me, that's a lot of what the book is about. It's about kind of forgiving yourself and living with that horrible feeling of like, which is how most abuse happens, where the person who the abuser is both a loved person and a violent person towards you. So yeah, I wanted to capture that, and I wanted young women to read it. But again, young women read all kinds of books. That's
like,
fine.
I'm maybe not familiar enough with YA, but makes me think of more like The Hunger Games. So that's the thing. Which I can understand the switching the order to not have the more kind of literary approach. So immediate at the start. But I maybe need to read more YA.
Yes.
As you sort of say, you want everyone to read it, but from this sort of traumatic side of things and this sort of being able to look reflectively on what happened to your younger self and the way of dealing with trauma, I think that is like a good thing to point to people in the direction.
Mm.
Because I think it can be used as a sort of dramatic device so much.
Yeah.
I think that really does not feel like that's how it's going.
Yeah.
It feels very honest to what, you know, that experience must be like, I think. And that's, it's not that it sort of sets up, it's not, you can see on the horizon this big terrible thing that's going to happen.
It's
much more honest reflection.
It's very interesting because I always wrestle with myself, you know, how subtle to be. And I don't know why, but in my head, being subtle is really classy and being and unsubtle is, you know, whatever. And there are some people who read the book, and I mean, the politics are kind of complicated, but especially sort of sometimes, it hasn't been reviewed by that many men, but someone might come out saying like, oh, what a lovely book about bicultural identity. And I'm like, yeah, it's about, definitely, obviously about that. But it's, there's one review that called it like a book about millennial dating. And I was like, you know, anyway, so I mean, it's incredible to me that the sexual violence can just completely go over some readers' heads. And for other people, it's just so obviously what it's about. So yeah, it's just interesting to me.
Yeah. I wonder if men and women maybe, I mean, obviously across the board, but if they would tend to have different responses to it.
Mm.
To get a sample together.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't know, you're fluent in Portuguese. Was it ever an option or a thought to write in Portuguese rather than in English? Or is it already kind of coalesced to the stage of being a novel in English by the time you sort of realised it was going to be a novel?
That's so interesting. I mean, my vocabulary in Portuguese is just not as large as my vocabulary in English at all. And it's also really skewed towards like childish words. So it's kind of that's just quite limiting, but quite interesting. So the other thing is, I don't know how much Portuguese I could get away with putting in there. Like what I've got in there is fine, clearly, but, and I think the trend is changing slightly. People are putting more words in. And again, I didn't have a glossary. And there's a kind of new market because of the Latinx population in the US and also I guess the amount of Latin Americans who speak English for bilingual like TV shows, for example, and a few bilingual books. And by bilingual, I mean like actually half and half. Like, so it's really interesting that that market exists in those two languages. I don't think there are that many markets like that. So basically, no, because my vocab's not big enough, and two, no one would ever publish a Portuguese English book or... but having said that, I'm putting more blocks of Portuguese in the second book. And the other thing that's interesting is, when I finally showed my mom the book, she just sent me this really emotional text, blah, 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 blah. And then I was like, Mom, can you spell check it for me? And because, you know, a British publisher doesn't have like my proofreader and my copy editors are all, they're not bilingual, so and I couldn't stipulate that in my contract. Never occurred to me they probably have said no. So anyway, that's also slightly funny, and I think there is one spelling mistake, but wow. I'm not going to say what it is. But
has anyone got in touch with you about that?
No, I just saw the same word printed in a book in Portuguese, and I was like, oh shit. But anyway, I mean, it's obviously completely fine and authentic to the experience of like what that text actually is. But
that's maybe the difference between Portuguese from Portugal and from Brazil.
Yeah, there are, that word I think is just spelled a certain way.
Surely it's a dialect place that whoever complains about this hasn't been to.
But in this book, I guess it's slightly different. It will get published, you know, I can take more risks, and yeah, so there's going to be more blocks of just Portuguese.
Will you translate them in the book? Will there be?
No, definitely not, no.
Okay. I have strong opinions about this, but I think Portuguese is okay. I've ranted about this before. I think if it's Latin or French, it really, really winds me up if people don't translate, because I think it's a class signifier. And I get it, but I think for other languages...
I think, what you were saying earlier about the sort of colonialism or the dominant languages, I think quite often in books it's put in not, it's a different motivation, I think, than when you're bilingual and you're writing chunks of text in one of the languages you speak. It's completely different.
Yeah, I mean, like,
adding in a Latin phrase.
Completely. Like, I think it's entirely about, like, what is the actual effect of you doing that? Does it mean that people are sat there and they're constantly reminded, like, okay, I don't know any Latin, like, fuck off. Like, but, and similarly with French, like, who are you excluding? Like, who are you, like, what is the effect? Is it that there are just, like, certain readers that have certain educations that have access to that right off the bat? And if that's Greek or Latin, like, I'm not into that.
Yeah.
But if it's, like, a migrant language, I think that's cooler. And, like, I often talk about, like, reversing the dynamic that migrants experience on the street when they don't have access to English. I think similarly, it's not just, like, languages, capital L. It's also, like, there are lots of books where slang is used and that excludes, like, the equivalent people who, like, for example, are only familiar with, like, RP or something. Mm-hmm. And I think that's doing a similar thing where the code switching, like, can your reader keep up or not? But yeah, I'm with you. Like, I'm not here for chunks of Latin or whatever.
I guess it's what the set, I mean, if a book is set in Senegal and people are using some French, or even France, that's fine. If it's a load of upper class people
who've gone
who are staying at a country house somewhere in England and they can speak in French to each other, then I'm just
going to
throw it
in the bin.
I mean, that's, I'm not really reveling in my own ignorance there. I'd love to be able to speak
as many languages as I could, but
it's that thing about pushing the reader away rather than
it
being part of the flavor, like talking about, you know, foods or cultural things they might not be aware of.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to explain everything. And I think that goes back to the thing you were saying about subtlety earlier.
Like, yeah.
If a book's doing too much work for you, suddenly it feels quite sort of artless and clunky. So.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Yeah.
In The Stubborn Archivist, it's quite a lot of, it seems biographical sort of material. And at the same time, it's fictional. Did you feel any kind of conflict between wanting to write sort of truthful, realistic, biographical account and a urge to sort of heighten things and make it more sort of plot driven? Or was that a conflict at all in the writing process or editing, or is something that didn't occur?
I wouldn't say I heighten things. I think sometimes you neaten things up to make them a little bit fit better, less sort of, like, real life's so random, like, but I mean, in terms of it being biographical or not,
not so much whether it is biographical or not, more about the tension between having an idea and the way you kind of present it,
yeah,
so whether you sort of fictionalize more or less, or like that decision, you know, it's not a yay or nay, it's a scale, I guess, a lot of the time, but how you approach that, of whether you sort of went full towards the fictionalizing or if it was different in different cases and different scenes.
I guess, like, I just think real life is so much more complicated than the novel I was writing. There are so many more characters and so much random stuff that doesn't tell a story in life. And I felt like a lot of what I was doing was finding slices of the world that I was familiar with and arranging them. And I think that's probably what lots of writers do. Even if you're writing something historical, you're still doing that to an extent. And sometimes it's more recognizable to the reader. Whether or not they're recognizing everything accurately is a kind of different question. But, like, yeah, that's what I feel I do, is I take sort of strands and things from the world that I live in and then cut them up and paste them into a story that makes people feel things.
And do you end up casting aside characters and kind of associated bits of the story that just don't fit all?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the family in the book in some ways is similar to my family in terms of, like, that kind of class position and being Brazilian and British and stuff, but I mean, God, in real life they're way more complicated. There are way more people. I mean, a character like Richard, I mean, obviously I did a thing on purpose where the fleshiest people in the book are the women, but, you know, we don't hear anything about his English family and their World War II PTSD and, like, you know, all the stuff that they're going through. And similarly, something else I did, I guess when I was, I guess it's just like I want the politics to feel true and the representations to feel true in that sense. Like, I've never, like, if I'm going to write, part of why I chose to write about this, like, upper class white Brazilian family was to talk about class politics in Brazil and, like, how that complicates when you migrate and this perspective where you're seeing these things, I guess. So I would never try it. I'd always try and bring that out rather than, like, whitewash that. But something that I found myself doing, which I'm not sure about, is, like, very conscious of the fact that, like, Brazilian men are so, Latino men are so sort of, like, over-sexualized and portrayed a certain way. And I always try and show these men as being not that. But then in real life, sometimes they really are. So it's sort of an irony where I sort of had finished writing the book and I was going to get published and I went to Brazil for research for the second one. And I just remember being really sexually harassed and being like, fuck you guys, like, I'm so good to you in my fiction.
And so, is that something you think you would represent in future, or do you feel that that's such a thorny...
I think I can. I think it's okay. I think, like, again, it's like if you've got, in this book, in Southern Archivist, I had the grandpa who is old, he's not, I don't know, who knows what he got to when he was younger, but there's Marcos, there's only really, and there's Thiago, there are only two prominent, like, Brazilian men in the book, so... But if in the next book there are like 10, then I think I might make, I don't know, it's sort of different question, isn't it? Like,
and is the next book going to be more sort of substantial in terms of length?
Yes. So it's got two protagonists, so double the fun. And one is from the northeast of Brazil and the story kind of starts there with her family. And the other one is from South London. So... yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like a two-headed Bildungsroman in that sense.
And is it more sort of plot-driven then? Or?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, it's still more like feelings-driven, but there are more like plot events. Like, people die. Yeah.
And is your family's background from that part of Brazil that you're writing about? I'm just thinking about the size of Brazil.
It's so big,
Britain. It's massive. It seems really quite different because of the different immigrant populations in the cities. So is there any bit of Brazil that you've written about without being familiar at all? Would you be happy doing that?
No, I don't think I would. Or I'd try and just zoom in on something very specific and get to know that. But so my family are from the southeast of Brazil. They're from São Paulo. But we have some very close family friends that we visit every year, well, most years, in Recife, which is in the northeast. So the second book, The Family, are from Recife in the northeast. And I was given a grant by the Society of Authors very generously to, like, go and spend some time there. Mm-hmm. And I did. And mostly I was just, like, hanging out and going out. But, like, obviously that's, like, legit research if you're writing about, like, people. but I was staying with my family friends and they were just like, what do you do? And I was like, no, okay, don't worry. But it was really interesting. Like, I went to visit the university and, like, all these different things. So, like, to a degree, yes. And it's quite, I think that part of that novel, like, it's just going to have to be very focused on the family life. Whereas in the South London part of the novel, I feel much more confident talking about, like, schools and social groups at school and stuff like that. And I think there's just no getting away from that. Like, they are just going to have different focuses and that's fine. And then there's also a part of that book that I'm still going to research using a lot of, like, archival material, hopefully, that will be set during the dictatorship and hopefully it'll be very sparse, but that might be in different parts of Brazil that I haven't gone to, but it'll also be in, like, a time that I cannot visit. So I will just have to work with what I have. And again, I think there's a way of textualizing that. Writing that in a way that acknowledges the fact that so much knowledge is lost between the generations. There's so much that's destroyed. There's so much that isn't passed on. And, like, there are going to be gaps in the way that we tell these stories because of that. So I can make it into a formal,
Do Brazilians talk about that period much, or is it everyone? There's just years in the history books where just nothing.
Well, it's such an open question. So I think I was always struck by how little it was part of the narrative of what Brazil is, and I don't say that to oversimplify what Brazilians talk about, you know, when they talk about Brazil. But I think in my family, it was a fairly big part of my mum's narrative of herself. And she came to England after the dictatorship finished, and she said she didn't feel like she could have left during, which again is interesting because so many people were exiled. It's not really a choice, but...
Like she felt she couldn't leave, or she physically couldn't.
No, she could have left, but I think she felt like it was her duty to stay and fight. Mm. But it was always striking to me how, in general, Brazil wasn't talked about as a democracy that was like only slightly older than me. And of course, the book also bookends, Sovereign Archivist bookends the end of the Cold War to the beginning of like Brexit, Trump, Bolsonaro. Like it's deliberately talking about this period that feels like stability. The dictatorship, a lot of what they did was use this like narrative of that kind of Brazilian economic prosperity to justify killing indigenous people and to go into those areas to get resources. It's quite similar to what's happening now. It's very similar. And the militarization of Brazil is very connected to the way mostly black Brazilians, poor black Brazilians, are just killed, extrajudicial killings by the state. Again, it's similar to Black Lives Matter, what's happening in the US, because these are societies that were built on slavery and never dealt with that. And there's still huge white supremacy. And so there's a lot that hasn't been reckoned with in Brazil's past. I think the military dictatorship, that's something I'm really interested in this second book, is that as a moment where power could have shifted to the left, and like how scary actually the right find that. And that's something that we're seeing. I think that's relevant to what's happening in the UK. I think that's happening to what's happening in the US. I feel like a lot of the rise of the far right is very connected to this demographic shift, you know? And I'm interested in that. And I'm interested in how we can only understand that by going back to colonialism and settler colonialism and empire and industrialization. So they're really big questions, but yeah.
Within Brazil culture, is it sort of similar to, I always feel that in Britain, within sort of literature, I guess, which is what I'm more familiar with, there is a quite a left-leaning tendency. Mm. I don't know if this is the only culture I really know about. And is that similar in Brazil? Is that...
Yeah, and in fact, you just reminded me of something I did, which I forget. Yes, I think so. And also universities, and there's a huge attack on universities, again, because universities are places of archive where knowledge is stored. There's this thing called Escolas Sem Partido. So, I mean, literally translates to like schools without party, but it's like the idea that like anything that actually teaches history where things like genocide are acknowledged as like Marxism, and like Bolsonaro set up a hotline for you to report your professors. Like, it's completely wild. Like, but just going back to literature, like, I think now, yes. And in particular, there's a really big like Afro-Brazilian movement of literature. And by literature, like, I guess I'm referring now to books, but also music. So a lot of what I draw on is like Brazilian music, and popular culture resistance to the dictatorship was often like love songs, but they were not actually about, they might have been like actually love for your country or freedom or something like that, but they had to be coded in a certain way. So that's, the songs in the book are like that. And it's so interesting, like Caetano Veloso, and lots of different people, they were exiled in London. So there's just loads of different connections. And I mean, there's one song, I think it's, I've forgotten the name, but, that's about how nice London is and how the police are nice to everyone. And this is like within like months of the Notting Hill riots. Like, so there's such a disconnect between like what different people are experiencing and migrant groups in different countries, which I'm really interested in. So yeah, there's a really big popular culture movement, not just like literature capital L, that's very politicized in Brazil, and there's a very long, very, very long tradition of that, that, yeah, I think is really, really cool. I see myself in conversation with that as well.
And then Brazilian writers at the moment starting to engage. I mean, I guess it's quite recent that Bolsonaro has actually come to power, but the winds must...
Yeah, they absolutely are. There's a short story collection that I reviewed called The Sun in My Head by Giovanni Martins, who's great. He was in London, I met him. And that's, it's also doing such cool stuff with form. It's like a short story collection all set in the favelas in Rio, and it's mostly about like black and brown Brazilians. But it's, again, not glorified. It's a best representation, like again, it's not my experience, so I'm not speaking saying how accurate it is, but it talks about like gang violence, police violence, sex, drugs, but like without glamorizing machismo, without glamorizing that situation, but actually just being like, what does it mean to work under capitalism and globalism? Like, it's just so smart and it's full of slang and it's just great. And the translation's wonderful in English. And like, for example, yeah, like his Instagram is very politicized. It's very like, it's not naive at all. I think I find that's the other thing. The idea that he's just talking about his experience is just bullshit. Like, he's very politicized. And so he'll post like, Free Lula, etc. And yeah, you have like the old school, like Chico Buarque and Caetano Veloso are also posting every day. Like, Elsa Suarez, also such an icon. So yeah.
I need to refamiliarize myself with more Brazilian writers, I think. But then it might be your Portuguese pronunciation. I've always pronounced that as
But again, you'll be like, oh yeah, I've heard that, like, you know, elevator music that's actually about dictatorship, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, like, the disconnect, you'd say, between the past and how it comes into the present. It seems so often like, I'm not so familiar with Bolsonaro, but a lot of the right wing, it's kind of preying on a certain kind of image of the past, but at the same time disconnecting from the past and how that works. It's a strange times at the moment around the world, I think. But,
absolutely.
So I guess we're sort of coming up to time to wrap it up. Just with the next book, so you feel like you're about 60%.
Yeah.
If you had a sort of imaginary countdown. How does the process work with your editor now? Is it being edited externally as you've gone along, or are you going to finish this, pass it on?
No, I finish it. And there's no contract, so like nothing happens if I never finish it, apart from me being sad and everyone being disappointed. But there's no deadline either. But yeah, Fleet were really good to me, so I really like them. I worked with a wonderful editor called Rhiannon Smith, who's just really comfortable with the like formal experimentation, had some great insights about indents, basically taught me what like line break is properly, because I was writing like as if I'm writing on the internet, just like press return, but actually like indents is not like that in books. So and yeah, I guess that's something that we didn't touch on that much, but I think it's interesting, is like how I think growing up with MSN Messenger and the internet influenced my form. I think it's probably why I just don't punctuate stuff. Like, it just seems unnecessary to me. slash aggressive. What I do is, yeah, I like draft the different bits and then I might chop them up and put them in a different order. And then I do this thing where I record myself reading out loud, and then I can listen to it and be like, oh, that sounds terrible, or the rhythm's not right, or something, and go back to it. And
so do you do that once you've got it in the order that you're sort of happy with, or do you read sections prior to that before you decide where they all go?
I have to have something like a draft, because otherwise it's just horrible to listen to. I'm just like, this is all shit. Delete it all. So I don't know, I might have a section that I'm ready to read out, but not the whole thing, for example.
Okay, I mean, I've tried doing this. I'm interested in how you actually do it practically.
Yeah.
So my issue was, as well as feeling really self-conscious about doing it, I would then be just pause each time, stop it, read.
Yeah.
Whereas I think what you want to try and do is just to hear the proper flow of it. So how do you just keep stopping and making amendments, or do you have it printed out, do you note down as you go along, or...
What I used to do is, when I was commuting to my job, I used to listen to it, and it used to be a way of just being able to write while I had to be on the tube.
Yeah, that's quite a good opportunity, sort of time.
Yeah, and essentially what would happen is I'd just get so annoyed by the bits that weren't right that, yeah, I'd just make a note of them or come back to them and, yeah, maybe stop it if I was like, oh, it's too horrible, I need to change it.
So you'd read it, the whole section of that you were wanting to look at in one go.
Well, because things just tend to be slightly less ready than each other, like for Slavon Archivist, I'll just read different chapters and then go back to them. And it's quite tiring to read out like a whole book in one go. So that's what I'd do. But I mean, ideally, yeah, I'd just be able to listen to the whole thing and get, and also because it's that newness that I think is really useful. It's like printing it out. You just come to it slightly fresher and you're able to, it's like when you send it off to someone and you're suddenly like, oh, see all the changes that I should make because you're reading through their eyes. So like trying to recreate what it, the experience of reading it for the first time or reading it all in one go. It's just tricks of doing that, I think.
Thank you to Yara Rodriguez-Fowler for joining us. Yara is on the social medias. You can find information on where she is and what she's on in the episode description. If you would like to find out more about me and my work, it's jamiebatchin.com is my website, spelled in my idiosyncratic manner. At Jamie Batchin on Twitter or at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at LachlanBloom.com or on Twitter at LachlanBloom. And do remember to like, rate, subscribe the podcast wherever you find it online, or follow us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods.
Or graffiti a local landmark.
Yeah, ideally graffiti a local landmark.